When authority vanishes, the Lord of the Flies Beelzebub brings chaos and death. Our last episode on the Lord of the Flies explored how the young boys revert to barbarism in the absence of authority. The question this week, what happens when the authorities drive society into the barbarism? In the first instance of the Lord of the Flies, the boys held some hope that circumstances would change and authority would return. In the second instance, Hunger Games, our story for today, the authority itself required them to fight for one another. For the children in the Hunger Games, no hope for the return of authority to bring about order and out of the chaos exists. At the same time, what happens when the government requires this barbarism as the means to entertain a nation? Where do we draw the line between entertainment and murder? Perhaps the major theme of this book is not about children killing other children, but about what passes for entertainment on our TVs and the internet. Throughout the entire book, the main characters act and perform in this reality TV show in such a way as to always entertain the audience and bring delight to the audience. A gruesome reality. Welcome to Lies Speaking Truth. This is episode 2, and our story today is the currently popular Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. I am Roy Askins, and my co-host, Chris Gillespie,
hello,
is here also. How are you doing, Chris?
I am well.
As always, please be aware that this show contains spoilers. If you want to read the book and haven't yet, please pause the podcast, go and read it, and then come back and listen. Secondly, I wanted to be very clear that we are not literary scholars, but theologians. We aren't here to read Christianity into every story we review. Rather, we analyze the themes of the book and comment on them in light of the Christian theology. We look at where a book might potentially be harmful to the faith, as well as where a story might help and encourage our faith as well. Our story today is The Hunger Games, and it's currently one of the best sellers. Part one of the story today begins with we kind of get the context here, and it's some sort of post-apocalyptic society, some future time after a major conflict of some sort, presumably some sort of nuclear disaster in which half the world is killed. The setting is North America, but not as a political entity. That's geographic. The U.S. is divided into 12 districts at the time, all of them controlled by the Capitol. At some time prior to our story, the districts tried to revolt and overthrow the Capitol, and they almost succeeded. But when the Capitol regained control, they instituted the Hunger Games as a means of keeping control over the district, the different districts. And all the districts, the way the Hunger Games work is that all the districts supply two tributes. These are children between the ages of 12 and 18, one boy and one girl, and they are chosen by raffle to compete in the Hunger Games. And the Hunger Games essentially conclude when only one tribute is left alive in this massive outdoor arena. And the tributes basically have to fight each other and kill each other. We also get in the first part the background story on Katniss, our main character. Her father worked in the coal mines and is now dead as a result of some sort of hidden explosive mine upon which he stepped. After his death, Katniss cared for her mother and daughter, keeping them alive with the skills she learned from her father, skills of illegally hunting and gathering outside the wire, we might say. The time comes then for the selection of the tributes for the games. As I said, the way that you are chosen is basically by a raffle. The older you are, the more likely you're to be chosen. You have more tickets in the pot to be selected. Katniss's sister, however, who is only 12, ends up becoming the girl chosen from District 12, which is the district Katniss is from. And Katniss volunteers to be tribute in her place. The other tribute, the young boy, is Peeta, a young man who we later find out cared for Katniss even prior to their mutual selection as tributes. The final selection or section of Part 1 describes the great lengths to which the Capitol goes to prepare the children for the games and the great lengths to which the Capitol goes to ensure that all the viewers in all the districts actually get a good show. It's here that Peeta declares his love for Katniss and what she perceives to be a power play, but in fact does not think that he truly cares for her. And this story, the story of this romance, and the fact that she actually has affections for a different young man back in District 12, is a theme that undergirds a good portion of the story.
Part 2 comprises the actual games themselves. The scene opens as the tributes stand ready for the opening scene, which is referred to as the bloodbath. The entire games take place in a massive outdoor arena, as Roy said, monitored by cameras, which is curious that they never tried to take out the cameras, but anyway, which record everything that happens in the arena.
I think the cameras are invisible. Like they don't know, they never know where the cameras are at. They just know that they're there
somehow. Yeah, however that works. The center of the arena where the first scene takes place and where almost half the tributes die is called the cornucopia. Which is appropriate this time of year, which has all sorts of supplies. Only the strongest survive to collect food and resources there. So the major portion of the story, though, in this part is telling the story of Katniss as she struggles to survive, care for a young 12-year-old girl named Rue, who is from a different... Is that correct? Is it Rue?
Yes.
Okay, Rue, who is from a different district, as well as avoid getting killed herself and... rejoin with PETA, but that's in part three.
Yes.
Moving on. In the midst of the game, the Capitol changes the rules, so it is possible for two people to make it out alive. So the obvious connection then, being Katniss and PETA. Capitol makes a big deal of playing up the romance, which of course began before the games began. In the end, when Katniss and PETA are the only two remaining, the Capitol changes the rules again, or they return to the original rules, so that only one can remain standing. Katniss refuses to put up with it and decides to commit suicide with PETA in order to stick it to the Capitol, or to the man. For some reason, she thought the whole thing would fall apart if there wasn't at least one tribute standing at the end. Just before they kill each other, the Capitol changes position and allows them to live. Because that would be, what, in the interest of the games.
I honestly didn't understand why she thought that... That was going to be a problem if they both died. Like, what does the Capitol really care if they both die?
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Anyway.
Did you get that? Were you? Okay,
yep.
Good.
The story concludes with a couple of chapters on the dangers PETA and Katniss face after the Hunger Games. They torqued off the Capitol because they didn't put on the good show Capitol was hoping for. Thus, with the help of others, they finally make it home. During the course of the return home, it comes out that Katniss isn't on the same page emotionally as PETA, and the book ends with them entering the great unknown of their own home, romance as yet unresolved, holding hands, but that's it.
Just to put on a good show.
Just to put on a good show, because that's what the Capitol would want. That's what their captains, or whatever you want to call their coaches, would want.
Right.
Yes.
So that's a basic overview, and of course we missed a lot. There's a lot more in the story, other characters. I thought the characters were fairly well developed, which I guess kind of brings us to the first question. Does it succeed as art? You know, are the characters well developed? Are they flat? Do they have, you know, a life of their own? And I don't know. I mean, I thought that, like, characters like Rue, I mean, that was a pretty unique character, the young girl who was rather lively. I don't know, the context I thought was, well, not entirely new. Wasn't entirely recycled either.
I agree to some effect, at least with Katniss and PETA. I mean, the two of them clearly are the main characters. Really, mm-hmm. I mean, Katniss is the main character.
Right.
But PETA
in the sense
is,
that it's the whole book is first person point of view from her perspective.
Correct. But PETA, on the other hand, we do get a significant amount of his backstory, and that's set up for us, you know, that they'll be reunited at some point in the story, and that there's more going on with him than meets the eye. So that's pretty good. The other characters, I wasn't as pleased with their description earlier in the book, and then then how that plays out. There was too much of a time lapse. I didn't necessarily make the connections. We didn't have any other interactions because the characters aren't allowed really to interact with each other apart in the dining hall during the training. But apart from that, they're really kept apart. You know, I would have hoped for more interaction because it made it very impersonal, but of course maybe that's part of the point.
I think that is part of the point, but it's also, I mean, you do get some development of her mother and her sister in the flashbacks she tells. There's a lot of flashbacks throughout the entire book where she goes back to the life that they had after her father died, but before being chosen or volunteering for the games. And so you get some development, definitely of PETA that way, but you also get some development of Prim, her sister, and her mother.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you want to speak of the aesthetics, I mean, despite the ending being a cliffhanger, which, of course, we kind of talked about, I think both of us would have a desire to find out more about these characters. I mean,
yeah.
We're curious where development will take them, you know, and right. their lives. And, you know, my hope would be that we'll find some maturity in them. Because there's kind of a token maturity out of the desperation of life and death, but not really in behaving in a moral sense, which is what we're getting to here in a minute.
This is what we're drawing this from is, once again, as we said in our pilot episode, where we working with Dr. Gino Rudvith's Reading Between the Lines. And he talks about how Mortimer Adler, writing about beauty in artwork, distinguishes between the enjoyable and the admirable, and that a piece of artwork to succeed must be both enjoyable and admirable. And here, we're discussing is whether, as a piece of artwork, it's enjoyable. And now, turning to the morality, I guess you could say, of the book, is it also admirable in that sense? Is the story told in such a way that it supports a Christian morality, but even just a basic morality of natural law? It doesn't necessarily have to be a Christian morality. And I don't know, I think it does. Even though the story is about children killing other children, I think the underlying theme is that this is not a good idea.
Right. It's clearly, it's clearly imposed upon the characters. And what we learn from the main character, that it's only done in desperation or even by accident. Right. And then out of mercy too. You know, out of necessity of providing mercy, is that she does it.
Yeah, so, the very last kill that Katniss makes is the character that they were. There were three of them left. It was Katniss, Peeta, and Cato, I believe, was the last character.
Correct, Cato.
And Cato was the strongest one, possibly the most likely to succeed next to Katniss. Katniss was able to use a bow and arrow and was very deadly in that sense. But Cato was also very strong and could throw the spear very well and
as far as she could shoot.
Right, exactly. He had basically trained his entire life for this. And so next to...
He was career man, right? One of the career players. Yeah.
Right, he had been trained for this his entire life, even though that was technically illegal. So next to Katniss, he was the most likely to survive. And the end of the story, closing to the story, he's laying there almost dead, but not dying. He laid there for hours, and she finally kills him out of mercy. Rather than actually out of hatred. And she never actually enjoys the killing. I think there's one part where she was glad to take out retribution on the boy that killed Rue, her young companion, but she never really actually took delight in it. She did it out of necessity.
Right. So, I mean, I was going to say her first kill with the bee things?
Not Tracker J's. Jackers.
Tracker Jackers. Yeah, she knocks this tracker jacker nest off the top of the tree. These will kill pretty much instantly if you have enough bites of them. And she did take out the I forget the character's name, but took out the character quite quickly with those.
Was it Glimmer?
Correct, it was Glimmer. And she was, I think she regretted it, you know, in a sense, mostly because she had to retrieve the bow and arrow from her, through her decomposing body, which is kind of disgusting. But, so that was her first, really. I don't know. Did anyone else die from those? My memory's not so good on that.
I don't recall either.
Well, in any case, that was out of self-defense, truly. And, but it was also protecting Rue already at that point.
Right. In fact, I don't recall, did she ever kill anybody just to, like, did she ever hunt somebody down to kill them?
No. Well, I mean, Cato at the end, but
her intent was, but she never actually fulfilled it.
No, I mean, it was a fatalistic one. She knew that this was all that was left. The game had to end. Right. There was no other choice.
Right. And the underlying theme, I think, throughout the entire book is... the grotesqueness that this is done for entertainment, that the entire nation, all 13 districts, you know, the capital and all 12 districts are doing this, watching this to be entertained. You know, she said at the beginning, part of the reason they do it is to keep the district in line. But as she remembers her own life, sitting there watching the Hunger Games, she remembers the delight at which she watched these other kids being killed. And she realized, now that she's in the scenario herself, how grotesque this is. And even though, like I said, even though it's kids killing other kids, the underlying theme is what we'll do for our entertainment, you know, and the grotesqueness to which we will descend in order to be entertained.
The idea of the Hunger Games as a deterrent from uprising, I think, is a curious one, because, you know, usually the way that you're motivated, of course, to avoid that which, or to be deterred from something is through the law, right? To some kind of, this it's called an unlawful enterprise, so you just don't do it because you don't want to be caught or whatnot. But she is, our character Katniss is forced to break the law, right, to hunt and gather outside the fence, to trade in ways that would be, trade things that would even be illegal, in order for the preservation of her life. And yet they do something that should be illegal, and yet it's not only legal, but it's done for entertainment in order to actually keep people in line. So they're willing participants in their own demise, really, as a moral nation.
Yeah. Well, and she also notes how the Hunger Games are a cause for celebration for everybody except the family of the two children chosen.
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, that you know, she recalls how if she had been at home instead of on the train to Capitol, she would be having a little feast with her family. And she was out hunting in order to gather a feast for the Hunger Games, right? A feast to go watch these people kill each other. I mean, it's just, it's grotesque.
Well, I guess my question is simpler than that. How is it that the Hunger Games actually prevent any of the districts from uprising?
And see, that's the thing. I don't think in reality they would. I didn't get that. That's one of the things I didn't get in connection with why they would be upset that nobody was left alive. I just don't know how doing the Hunger Games would prevent an uprising. Of course, obviously, it's to show the power of capital, but frankly, if my children are being stolen from me, or there was the risk of my children being taken from me and having to be, trained to go slaughter other kids, that would probably torque me off and be more likely to cause an uprising than otherwise.
Yeah, you know? And I think the point is it's not the game. It's actually the hunger. That the controlling factor of the capital is that they control the wealth. They control food and resources. And as long as they can control the resources, the games are actually just for their entertainment. They really are to show, to delight in their power over the other districts. Which you see when you, the stark contrast of those who are representatives of the capital that live in the district, but then especially when you get to the capital and the way of life and the means of life. It's actually just a way of delighting in their oppression of the other of the districts, and that's why we'd want to read more in the books, because we're going to presume to learn more of the capital and the true nature of those of the people that rule there. So it is odd that those who are being oppressed would delight in their oppression.
Right, and maybe there's a deeper theme there. I just don't know that it doesn't make sense to me, and it just. To delight in watching your own children die, you know.
Yes.
And maybe that's the idea here. Is she's getting at is this? You know, the things we take. Maybe we should take a double look at the things we take delight in. Should we really be delighting in these things?
Right. Think of the newspaper, for example.
You know, and the front page.
Thankfully, I just canceled it because it was driving me nuts. Because for one thing, I want to control what news I receive, and the reason being is that I'm just not interested in, you know, the latest murder or the theft or how they're making all the students return their computers because they've been misusing them or whatever. I'm just not interested in these topics. I know that they happen. I don't need to know that they are happening. Right. I just trust that from my own knowledge of myself that these things are going to happen, and they are happening. So it's weird that we would delight in reading. I mean, that it's not what sells. That's what they say. I mean, we, it's the gory or the grotesque that sell. It's that which is, you know, wicked or evil that people right. are actually interested in. This is why they watch Jerry Springer or whoever the guy is now. They used to watch Jerry Springer, but well, if go somewhere where they have a television and they watch daytime TV. Like I was at the car wash, and they were cleaning my car out. You know, so it's a long story, but the point being is I watched. They had three shows in a row, and one show was so horrible. About the various, you know, teenage pregnancies and the arguments about who's the father and all these kind of things. It was just horrible because it was so immoral and the parents were irresponsible and they were, you know, complicit in the whole thing. And it was an hour long program and it was torturous. The next program they have on is the absolute polar opposite. It's a host. He's interviewing a family. You know, who's living without electricity voluntarily. And, you know, it was kind of a noble thing to learn what it's like to live with limited resources and all this kind of stuff. And then the next is helping inner city children, you know, get a proper education. And it was just like all this positive, and they were put next to each other on television. and so there's this intentional contrast to just show how wicked, but and yet how good the world is. And I think that's kind of one of the points of the book.
Well, that's where I was going to ask you about amusing ourselves to death. You're the one that turned me on to that book by Neil Postman.
Yeah.
And of course, it's a book about the medium and the message and how those affect one another. Can you give us a brief summary of that book?
Well, yeah, a brief summary of the book. Well, simply put, what Roy just said is true, is that the medium defines the message. So, in other words, what you're told on television isn't so much important as to how it's being told. So television is a particular media that tells a story a particular way. And we're trained to think in the way that television watches. For example, if you watch television the way I do, I pre-record it with a TiVo because I hate watching commercials because I don't need to be sold to. And the first twist happens at about 20, 21, 22 minutes on a typical drama. The next major twist, the major story changer, happens at right around 40, 42, 44 minutes, depending on when the commercial break comes. Every single show. Right? I mean, it drives my wife nuts because I'm like, okay, here comes the twist. We're at 39 minutes. And of course, there it is. So there's such a strong archetype. It doesn't matter if you're watching a cop show or you're watching a mystery show. You're watching a comedy, you know, if you're watching House MD or you're watching CSI or you're watching whatever, it doesn't matter. They're all the same.
The Unusuals, that's what we've been watching recently.
So they're all the same. You have the same, you've been trained for the expectation. And if they broke that model, the show would not be popular. It just wouldn't succeed because you're expecting to have that kind of cathartic release. Or that kind of suspenseful, you know, shift happen right at 42 minutes. You're just expecting it,
right?
Because you've been programmed to expect that. Of course, it affects everything else. You know, as preachers, this has a gross effect on how well people can listen because they're expecting these same kind of shifts to happen. And of course, we don't give them commercial breaks, which is part of something they expect now too, that they only have to think for about 6-7 minutes and then they get a break and they get to be entertained or commercialized for a bit. So Postman's theory is that we are manipulated by the media and that it ends up, no matter what we're trying to communicate with the media, it actually changes the content of, you know. So you can't, to use television for preaching, for example, he has a whole section on television preaching. And the television preaching ends up doing what television does. You're selling something, you're entertaining, you're not necessarily delivering content.
And I think that's the underlying message of Hunger Games. I don't think it really has anything to do with kids killing other kids. I think it has to do with the fact that everything they do in the book, you know, the whole romance that they play up together, that Katniss only plays along because she knows it's going to go well on TV, and that's what Capital wants. The danger she's in is because the story didn't end the way Capital wanted it to end. She changed the story. It's not as good as if her and PETA had to duke it out or PETA had sacrificed himself for her. That would have helped the They weren't ratings, but it would have helped the ratings go up, right? Every time she does something, she says, put the smile on her face for the people at home watching, you know, so that the story gets better and better. And I think the idea is that watching it on TV had enabled them to get past the grotesqueness of what they were doing. And the fact was, it was truly, in all reality, a reality TV show. You know, what passes for reality TV shows today aren't reality TV shows. They're still scripted. They're still, you know, they're not real reality TV shows. That right. was a reality TV show. And the reality of it was everybody at home watching it on TV was treating it as TV. You know, and the other thing at the end in part three, it was required watching, and she talked about how they would go through and edit it as she's watching it, you know, and she's narrating along with this first person present point of view, where she's talking about, you know, what they're going to edit and how they're going to edit out. I mean, she knows the whole story before it happens because she's seen it so many times on TV before.
Correct.
And the whole point is that what they're watching on TV enabled them to get past the grotesqueness of 12 to 18 year olds killing each other in a massive outdoor arena. And I think that's the underlying message is...
They became blind to it, really.
Right, right. And I think that's the underlying message that Suzanne Collins, whether she intends it to be or not, I don't know. But the underlying message I got from the book was, you know, we need to be careful about what we take delight in as our entertainment.
Yes, well, of course. Because hey, what did it end up being... Well, when even when there is no God, there you know a God comes in.
Right.
You know, the people desire something that they can worship, really, that they can cherish. And so here, you know, it's the Hunger Games, despite the fact that they hate it because it's merciless and it's vindictive. You know, there is still triumph in it. There is someone to root for. Yeah, you're right about destroying the expectations, and that. Both the expectations of the audience, she made it difficult for them to edit. They had to even, in their replay, you know, which was kind of torturous for her sitting there on the love seat with PETA, you know, to watch this, you know, all flash before her eyes again. It sounded like they didn't even show all the kills.
Right.
I mean, they did, but it was so overwhelmed by that, that creative, change in the story that really came through her preparer. What was his name? Cinna?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, this idea that they were going to present as couples, and this had never been done.
Right.
And to come out, you know, dressed in matching uniforms, but not just that, you know, that creative moment that's that, you know, indication, okay, hold hands, and how that changed the course of the whole entire games.
So much so that they even changed the rules just to make the story better, you know, and that's the point, right? That it made a better story if the two lovers had to duke it out in the end, right?
Anything? Yeah, I guess the point is that human creativity could not ultimately remain undermined. You know, that at some point the story that this game was not going to be able to continue as planned. Not just this time, if not this time, the next time.
Right. I mean,
at some point. There was going to be a break, and not because of fate or anything like that, just because this is the nature of man, that they're not inherently evil to the core. Maybe they are, but there is yet some creative aspect to them, you know, where right. they can do something unthinkable or just unique. And that was the story. And it so then you know you didn't watch replays of killings. You watched replays of you know a developing relationship, and yeah, and so then in the end, like you said, they had to change the rules and then change them back again because they didn't even as game makers they didn't even know how to deal with this story because the story was new, and it, you know, well maybe we should talk about the romance a little bit.
The romance, I think, well, I thought it was kind of poorly done. You know, I'm not the only one who thinks this. I know this is reading from Wikipedia, but somebody quotes Stephen King's review of it, in which he stated there were displays of authorial laziness that kids will accept more readily than adults, and that the love triangle was standard for the genre, and that the reality TV Badlands were similar to some other stories that had been written. And it equated, or not equated, but made some connection between the love triangle in this book and the love triangle of the Twilight series, which I have not read
yet. Which I have not read either, so I should mock it. I know lots of people have read it and enjoyed it. So, well, that's okay. But I mean, maybe that actually, because of the Postman theory, maybe it actually works to its advantage. That it's actually interesting because it is so common. I found it fatiguing in a way that, you know, I think, well, for one thing, it's written by a woman. It's clear, it's clearly going to be preferred by a female audience. Let's just put it that way. I mean, because the main character is female.
Right.
She's obviously, you know, got struggles with authority.
The story is first person point of view, which is also important to realize.
Right. And she's got, clearly she has difficulty because of necessity that she's repressed her femininity, you know, been more masculine, and now she has this opportunity to kind of come out of her shell a little bit and be something more appropriate for her sex. And, you know, these things are interesting to a teenage, preteen girl, I would think, because it's the same stuff they're going to be struggling with.
Right.
And so if it's done in a very paradigmatic way, I mean, maybe you've never read a romance novel, but you've probably seen a romance movie or two or four or a dozen, and they're all the same. They're all the same. There's always a twist, you know. Yeah. But the time travel ones are my preference, you know, because at least then it's interesting, you know. It's the medieval knight falling in love with the girl in modern day New York or something. But you know, that's okay.
And it's, you got the sci-fi, you know, the cool tools that you know.
Yeah, the sci-fi romances are fun. Those are good too. But at the same time, that's something we didn't see in our last book. I was just reflecting on, as a male author, all men on the island. And right. So they could actually deal with humanity in more of a one-dimensional, good-evil kind of way. Now, this book is a little bit harder to do this topic when you've got male-female, teenage, and dealing with good and evil in the context of also interpersonal relationships between the sexes. So, contrasting the two books next to each other was actually kind of interesting for me that way. But
yeah.
It's programmatic. There's no way around that. But so is the Hunger Games in general. So what was unique about it maybe would be something to look at. I mean, yes, okay, the love triangle was formula. But was it completely formula? She was faking it.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing, to some degree, I mean, the struggle, and this is what got annoying, is because she never knew throughout the entire book. You know, it was this, like, you know, I don't know, as somebody who's not in that life anymore, thank God, it just got annoying to, as she struggles, you know, it, back and forth between, do I love him, do I not love him, whatever. And I'm not mocking it. But the fact is that we have young adults that struggle with this, despite the fact that it's not a Christian worldview. You know, I know that we have young adults struggling with these very problems, and I know they're struggling with it and probably a way that's not necessarily God-pleasing. But at the same time, it gets annoying when you're reading it in the book.
Because it's false. It's fake.
Right. It's only an emotional love. I mean, and the thing is, you know, if you look at what true love is a series of actions upon which you decide to love someone as opposed to just feeling emotions, right? She only feels emotions for Gale, but she actually shows true love
right.
to Peeta by rescuing him.
Well, and it works both ways. I mean, if I was going to compliment her love story at all, it actually is about what they do for each other that the relationship develops. So, for example, from the get go, where Peeta defends her, or against the rest of the careers, so that she can escape. That was his first, you know, act. Well, actually, second. I mean, the bread was the first act, maybe, where he actually did something to demonstrate that it was sacrificial love. So, I we can't be completely negative upon it, because I do think, you know, in the context of the games, what actually builds that relationship is the sacrifice. And her throwing that away at the end was a little disappointing. I mean, I was sympathetic for her in kind of a sorrowful way, that you know, he had done a lot for her, and she had done a lot for him, and yet...
But she didn't throw it entirely away. I mean, that's part of the cliffhanger.
We'll be friends. Yeah, it was left as a friendship.
But it was even, I mean, if her sense of mind was that she wasn't sure even at the end. I mean, that's part of the cliffhanger, is that you don't know if she's actually going to end up with PETA versus Gale in the end. You just don't know.
Well, I don't know that she'll end up with either of them.
Right,
I don't even know that that's the point, because everything has changed now. Because now it's not a game between the districts, but now the game has begun between her and the capital. Well, frankly, right. The districts and the capital. That game is on again, because they understand, they see how this young girl can actually defy the capital and win.
Right.
You know, which is, even though they're trying to paint the picture as, you know, they're still the winners. Right. So what's the future of the games? What's the future? You know, how is this going to work out? It's a complete upheaval. The game cannot be the same again. The story has been rewritten. The formula has been broken. You know, so that's where the story will go. And consequently, the relationship between the capital and the districts has changed because of something. Something creative, something new has broken in and changed the world, really. And it was just, and it happened to be just this girl and her friend. So there's something to be learned there as far as a worldview. But
right. On to another question. What did you think of the mutations at the very end, where they took the tributes? Yeah, I was really surprised by that. That was one of the better twists in the book.
Yeah, it was right at the right point. It was right at 42 minutes.
I think I was probably further than 42 minutes into it. But at this point, it's the only Katniss, PETA, and Cato are left alive. And PETA and Katniss have gone hunting for Cato, and as they're hunting for him, they're waiting for him to come to the cornucopia, and they see him barreling across the prairie to see running behind him these mutations. What mutations are is where the capital goes.
It was actually mutations, by the way.
Yeah, I know, T's. But I saw that, but I can't pronounce it that way. It's a mutation. And this mutation is...
I thought it was clever. Mutations, like a mutt. I get it.
Yeah, but everything, like, how can you call a tracker jacker a mutation? That's not a mutation. It's not a mutt. A mutt's a dog. Anyways, okay. It's a mutation.
Anyway, tell us about these mutations.
Okay, the mutations are basically the former tributes transformed into these wolf-like creatures. They had died, been brought back to life by the capital, and transformed into these animals that now were coming to hunt Cato, Katniss, and PETA. And so Katniss figures this out, she's realizing that she's got to kill all these people a second time. You know, she's killed a couple of these tributes once, and now she's killing them a second time, once again to protect herself, you know, to defend her own life. So I just thought that was interesting. It was a good twist. Yeah. I liked how she played it out. Those mutations, or mutations as you call them, are what basically maul Cato within an inch of his life and then leave him laying there dying. You know, if he had died, at least according to the way the rules were at the time, the game would have been over. But the mutations, tortured him and brought him just to the, you know, cusp of death and left him there lying in agony. Yeah. And it's at that point that Katniss kills him in mercy, and supposedly is supposed to end the games, but it doesn't work out that way.
Right. So. Yeah. And I thought that was not just, you know, interesting, but actually very helpful to, you know, that is to demonstrate the complete and utter difference in character between Katniss and the capital. That's it. It's not that I think all the things going through her mind are just, you know, they're just thoughts she's having. In reality, that this is actually the capital trying to make her think as such. I mean, they've clearly, you know, placed the genetic data of the deceased into these creatures. I don't think any of her thoughts are probably accurate, that they carry any of the memories or whatnot. They carry the eyes and some, mm-hmm. and the physical form, but But that's
just enough to make her wonder if they're the real thing,
right? Because they're trying to play off the mercy thing. Yeah, so they're trying to get her to have mercy upon those who she ought not, who are out to kill her. And in the end, she defies them by actually having mercy upon the one that she shouldn't, from their perspective. That was helpful in really clarifying how far apart they were in their morality. Ultimately, what it comes down to. Then, you know, that morality is played out very well when they're visiting the capital. And especially in her resurrection of a sort at the end, you know, where she goes, and same with Peeta, that they actually, they remove all of her imperfections, which is inhuman.
Yeah. And she also noticed, and I thought this was really telling too, that when she's in the capital, that when the people she's with in the capital talk about the stories, they don't talk about her in the stories. They talk about where they were when a certain event happened during the game. So when she was killing so-and-so, you know, the people in the capital were thinking, I was here doing this when you killed so-and-so. And it wasn't about the fact that, oh, you actually had to kill this guy. You know, that it was entirely self-centered. It was all self-serving.
Right.
They couldn't get beyond themselves.
Right. Well, that's again, a media question. Whether or not television can convey humanity. I mean, think about it. I mean, how much television do we have that are serious dramas? Okay, we have some, but of what genre are they more specifically? Unless you watch PBS, where they you know, take a stage drama and turn it into a television production. Even then. Like you watch the BBC Sherlock Holmes thing, and you know it's supposed to be it's a crime drama though. Mm-hmm. It's about the darkest sides of humanity, including in Holmes and his contemporary, or it's, you know, it's CSI, and it's, yeah, they catch the bad guy, but there's rarely justice. It's always people are dying, and that's about the only thing that we can broadcast on television that's real. When you watch, when they try to show the good. You know, like, 19 and counting, which should be a good that this family has been blessed with 19 children, not going on 20, by the way. it turns into this gross spectacle,
right,
where they go and visit another family with 12 or with 14. And it becomes this just, I mean, it's supposed to all just be, you know, nice, but people watch it and they're amused by how weird these people are. It becomes a spectacle and not something to be rejoice in.
Right.
So that's something, I just don't know that television's capable of it. And the question is whether books can be too, but there seems to be, there's a possibility there.
I would think so, because the story is informed by our own imaginations, which are at least presumably more attuned to reality, perhaps. Who knows?
Right.
But this, I also want you to explain to me now why the death of them both cause the capital to fail. She says, listen, he says, Peeta says to me, pulling me to my feet. We both know they have to have a victory. It can only be one of us. Please take it for me. And he goes on about how he loves me, what life would be without me, but I've stopped listening, because his previous words are trapped in my head, thrashing desperately around. We both know they have to have a victor. Yes, they have to have a victor. Without a victor, the whole thing would blow up in the game makers' faces. They'd have failed the capital, might possibly even be executed, slowly and painfully, while the cameras broadcast it to every scene in the country. If Peeta and I were both to die, where they thought we were... Okay, and then she goes and pretends to commit suicide. So I don't understand how the game would blow up in the game makers' faces. Why do they have to have a victor? I don't understand that. Who cares if they both die? You know, you just watch 23 other kids slaughter each, or 22 other kids slaughter each other. What's two more?
Because it undermines the authority of the capital.
How so?
The authority of the capital is that they, through their game makers... have the whole thing rigged. I mean, really. I mean, they don't know all the details. They don't know exactly how it's going to work. But they flush them out with the fire. they send them out. They flush out Kato with the mutations or mutations, whatever you want to call them. Like I said, I think that's the goal of Miss Collins here, is to show how the undermining of the game is ultimately is going to be the victory. If they can undermine the game, that will actually demonstrate to the colonies that really the capital has just an authority that's built on straw, on lies. They really have no authority to come in and take their children.
They've lost control.
Right. And if a little, if how old is she? I forget.
16, I think. 15 or 16.
If this little, you know, if this child can undermine the capital, then why can't all the districts? It's just a setup for the rest of the next book. It's one big setup.
There. Right.
But, I mean, this is a development. I mean, this is classic in trilogies. Where the initial book is, it's just, you're learning, it's more curiosity about the world that is being created, and there's going to be a story, but the story is just surface level of the reality of the situation. The situation is far more desperate than, or it's more complicated even than what these games lend ourselves to think. So,
right.
That's why I'm saying the games are more important than even what we're led to believe so far in the book. But I haven't read the rest of the books, but that'd be my guess based off of the genre of trilogy. So,
which brings us to the next question. Are we going to read the rest of the books?
Well, I feel like I've invested too much of my time in these books. And you know, it's a quick read. and I really don't think that the romance element is going to play a strong part in the remaining books. It's so certainly going to be there, but I don't think it'll be the major element used for character development. Right. I think there's going to be a growing in maturity. I'm sure romance will come in again because she's a female writer and she's writing for female children. I mean, it's pretty clear. but at the same time, it's going to be leading the character towards a maturity of understanding the world, and that there are, frankly, just greater things than their little inner piddly, mock sexual relationships. This actually is a topic that I think we ought to respond to at this point, which is, the appropriateness for children. I mean, I was concerned. It began with the outfits. I don't remember which district's outfit, but the female one that was chosen. What do they call the people that are chosen? I just lost it.
Tributes.
Oh, the female tribute. Her outfit was described as sexy. It was some kind of gossamer, or it was see-through or something. And they referred to that a couple of times. And her nakedness is referred to a couple of times, the main character. Was it necessary? It just really wasn't necessary. Although it is true that they're playing off the sexuality of these children in their entertainment.
Right. You know? And I think in some sense that really lended to the story, in the sense that they're even turning the sexuality of these young children. Right? Didn't you say there was one year for the Hunger Games where the tributes came in stark naked, as a way to titillate the crowd, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, once again, the sexuality of these young kids are playing to the
so. I guess the point is that appropriate for children? I mean, it's going to. I think it's going to restrict its age appropriateness to, to a not a preteen, but to a teenage audience. At least for me, just because that's just not something I need to expose a child to. I mean, they just don't need to understand that until they're, especially you don't need to struggle with that, with the world on that until they have established firmly in their mind and in their experience through their own parents and through other, family relationships, a stronger example of what these interpersonal relationships are really about between male and female. And that it is, about sacrifice. It's not about romantic love in the worldly sense, but it's a love that is serving, and it's creative.
Love love as an act as opposed to love as an emotion is an important thing.
Correct.
Not that love as an emotion isn't there, but the primary mode of loving someone is not emotionally, but by virtue of acts and deeds.
Right. And that for example, you know, the creative act of marriage, the sexual act, is something that is for marriage. Whereas this book doesn't promote that, although they don't really, you know, get into anything hot and heavy. It's just kissing. But my children are younger than I would have read this book, and all they know of kissing is that this is what family do to each other to demonstrate, you know, their love for each other. But they don't think of it in a sexual way, that this is about, you know, falling in love or something. She uses that expression, falling in love, which is one of the things I wished in the post-apocalypse had just been lost. With the idea that you fall into love, but there it was. And I'm like, oh, well. Not my perfect post-apocalypse world. Well, and this is, I think, something that'll come out in the other books, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Capitol and those who are ruling in the Capitol are actually responsible for the apocalypse.
Right.
And for creating this world. They did it intentionally.
To control.
Yeah, to control, because think about it, each district is limited in its resource, what resource it gathers. And they're known by their resource. So, I mean, it's engineered. It's an engineered post-apocalypse world, which is weird. That doesn't make sense to me, which leads me to believe that it's not quite so post-apocalypse.
So. Not as post-apocalypse as you would like.
No. No, I prefer the ones where it's in utter chaos and there is no hope. And that's not this book.
Such as The Road, right?
Right, exactly, as we talked about.
This idea of the capital engineering the downfall so that they might control the districts segues into our next story, which will be 1984 by George Orwell. We're returning back to a classic work. I've not read 1984, but Chris has. So we'll be reading 1984.
I mean, honestly, 1984, you should have read before Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Yes. Yeah.
Amusing Ourselves to Death is a demonstration that 1984 is true. It's not fiction, it is truth.
In fact, he begins Amusing Ourselves to Death with a commentary on Orwell versus Huxley.
Right, and Huxley, of course, is more true than George Orwell. Huxley is brilliant. Orwell was smart. He had the right idea, but he had the wrong answer. And the wrong diagnosis. But we'll talk about that next time.
Right. Would you read the book again?
Well, I just, thinking about it, I don't think it has staying power. I don't know that I would read it repeatedly, unless, we'll just say it this way, unless its sequels add such a depth and a richness to the story that when you go back and read this book, there's more there than what we saw.
Right.
In a way that, for lack of a better example, you know, Star Wars was interesting, but it became a lot more interesting in light of Empire Strikes Back.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It was kind of creative, and it was, oh, that was nice. But then when you see Empire Strikes Back, you realize there's a lot more to that story than what I really thought was going on. And so it has potential, but we'll have to read the other books to know that for sure. But on the surface, I would say not throw away, but certainly not a repeat classic.
You know, Lewis here said, a book isn't worth reading once if it isn't worth reading more than once. Well, that's not a direct quote. That's kind of a paraphrase. But I think there is something, you know, you read a story and you look back, can I read this again? And if you can't, and of course, many people are going to argue, well, I don't ever read my books more than once, whatever. So what Lewis meant is a story that has staying power is a story that that is multivalent. It's got multiple levels.
Correct.
And each time you read it, you're going to see something new in it that you didn't see beforehand. And I just don't think, unless, like you said, the series adds more depth to it in some way.
Well, she clearly did not intend this book to be an autonomous book.
Right, right. It ends with an obvious.
So it's
this
probably
going to continue.
It's probably unfair to judge it as anything but part one of three.
Right.
And you know, and that being said, you know, it's really hard to say whether or not it is multivalent. I mean, I just don't know. It seemed to have some levels of thing going on, but only with the characters, not so much with the context, which is really, I think, where the meat of the story is going to be in the context.
Right.
You know, the relationship, the history of these districts, and then whether she and Peeta or whoever she gets, you know, works with Gale, they can enlist help. There can be a rebellion. You know, they can overcome and become human again.
Or do the game makers change the game again and she gets re-enlisted back in the game?
Well, and the reality is it's just not a game at all. I mean, in the end, it's just not a game. I mean, it's life right. and death, and it's not a game. You know, it's disturbing for us that they there's no consideration of afterlife, you know?
Or the value of life, period.
The value of life, yeah. Even the character's own, you know, desperate, you know, need to remain alive. It isn't all that desperate. You know, they're willing to for suicide at the end.
Too quick. I mean, who honestly considers, and maybe there are people that consider this, but I mean, this was a split second decision. Let's both commit suicide on the hope that they'll change their minds at the last second.
And that's not the first time. You know, even when Peeta is lying by the in the mud, you know, camouflaged mm-hmm. there, you know, it's either and be healed or die quickly, you know. Right. And it seems like there's even a favoring. It's just lying here to die.
Right.
I'm hiding just in case I live, but, you know, I'm really right. just, you know, if I just died in the mud and nobody ever found me, that would be just fine. So that was bothersome to me. I mean, there's this, especially even in her hunting in the forest, that just willful endangerment of her life, maybe for the sake of others. But at the same time, you know, that self-preservation instinct has just been undermined, at least in the districts, not maybe in the capital. I don't know what to say of that. It's just inhuman is what it is, because we cherish what we've received in our life. There isn't anyone who doesn't, unless they're senile or demented. I mean, it wasn't that difficult a book.
No,
I'm gonna go back. I'm gonna go back home. And I'm gonna read some more of the a real author, and then
Game of Thrones,
which is it's so real. That's the difference. The characters are real. These are real people.
It's because of a character arc. Like, even, I mean, nobody really has a character arc in this story. She never really changes from the person she was when she left. That's something we should have talked about.
Desperately, but just playing a game. She's, yeah. I mean, she was playing a game in the forest, you know, to, you know, just to have winnings, you know, to feed the family. And then she's just playing the game for the capital.
Peeta doesn't change. Nobody changes in the whole story. There's no character arc.
Which is tragic, really.
It's flat. It's one-dimensional.
Hmm. Well, that's sad.
Yeah.
That diminishes its importance, of course.
Yeah. So, 1984 will be next by George Orwell. You can find us at liesspeakingtruth.org. You can contact us at talkback@liesspeakingtruth.org. We appreciate any feedback, and as we get feedback, we'll certainly be willing to talk about it and comment on it on the show. And if you have things you would like us to talk about and review, send us an email, make any recommendations you can.
So. Yeah, because then maybe we'll discuss something that is an apocalyptic fantasy or mind-bending social, philosophical dramas.